Welcome to the Emotions and Money podcast, where we unpack the psychology behind our investment decisions and why our emotions could be sabotaging our financial outcomes. I'm your host, Maya Fisher-French, and I'm joined by Paul Nixon, who is head of behavioral finance at Momentum Investments. And in this series of podcasts, we are explaining why, when it comes to investing, understanding your money emotions is as important as in understanding your investment itself. So Paul, in our last podcast, we really looked at behavior tax and how emotions can actually cost us money. But now, today we're going to look at personality types. And does a personality type matter? I mean, would I respond differently to you in making my money decisions?
Could possibly, yeah, absolutely. So
I'd behave better.
Yes, I mean, I think our personality we can think of is almost our factory settings that we get, you know, from our genetic code. And then obviously the environment is going to have an impact in how we formulate values, attitudes, and beliefs. And that's kind of how these two things fit together. Mm. So personality is important, yes.
Okay, so let's have a look at the type of personalities that we need to, and just be aware of. So, you know, when I was reading this stuff in your report, I was like, oh, that's me. It's something called OCEAN, or that psychologists call it. So maybe just unpack that.
Hmm. So another acronym, drowning in TLAs, three letter acronyms. So OCEAN basically is a summary of the big five personality traits in psychology. Now, it's, of course, human beings are a little bit more complicated than just five, but these are the big five are higher order personality traits. So all these sub facets kind of roll up into these big five. There's quite an interesting story about how this was discovered. So there's one book in the world, Maya, that contains a description of every possible behavior. Can you guess what that book is?
The Bible.
No.
No, Shakespeare. No.
The dictionary.
So, okay, yeah. Fair enough.
So what they did was that they sucked out kind of all the words in the dictionary that explained people or behavior. And they did a factor analysis to figure out if there were any groupings. And these are the five things that they came up with, right? Or that were sort of uncovered. So if we think of OCEAN, that gives us a nice sort of acronym or mnemonic to unpack these traits. So O is openness, also referred to as broad-mindedness. You know, so if you're out there reading five books at the same time, but like sort of a quarter of the way through each one, then you've probably got some of that, right?
Oh.
So it's people are curious.
You must see what the bedside table looks next
exactly.
to me.
Yes, there you go. So people who are by nature very curious, broad-minded, open-minded, open to new experiences. So that covers the O. So we're going to probably go into how this relates specifically to financial behavior.
Yeah, so let's maybe go through the acronyms, and then we'll unpack, I think, and actually go a little deeper.
So if we look at C, which is the next letter, that refers to conscientiousness. So, I mean, if you've got kids running around picking up their toys after themselves, I've got some very, very good news for you, because, you know, this personality trait is very positive.
There are children who do that.
Apparently, yeah.
So, but not mine.
These are the kids who left the marshmallow on the table, by the way. So the kids who develop techniques to focus more on the future. So, you know, if you actually watch those Stanford experiments, they're fascinating. So some of the kids covered the marshmallow, some sort of ignored it, looked to the corner of the room. Those were techniques that they were developing to focus more on the future and not obviously on the reward.
So they actually create techniques at that age. Mm. So they were aware that looking at that marshmallow would tempt them. So it's not that they looked at the marshmallow and weren't tempted. They recognized that they needed to adjust their behavior. Mm.
Such
a young age. Yeah. Oh, you're set up for success.
But indeed, so there were actually follow-up studies done, and kids who had that that personality traits, you know, earn more, had better relationships, et cetera, et cetera. So conscientiousness is also an important one in terms of EQ. So broad-mindedness is more closely related to IQ, so that curiosity. EQ, conscientiousness, because you're more you're very conscious of your behavior and the effect on others. So you're consequence driven, right? So you're, by the way, as well, it's just fascinating as well that people with this trait tend to drive better as well, because you're more, again, focused on consequences in the future. So speeding, for example, you're aware of what that could,
so you're quite future orientated.
Exactly.
Okay,
spot on. Yeah. And then if we move to the E, it's extroversion. So there's the life of the parties out there, people who, you know, kind of find it very easy to make social connections, for example, quite dominant behavior as well. Then the A is agreeableness. Those are the empaths out there. So very, very aware of people's moods and sort of adjusting their own moods accordingly. And then the bad one, The nail envy is for nail biters, and also neuroticism. So that's the anxiety trait, right? So anxiety, it's a pathological trait because people with this trait tend to have higher levels of cortisol in their bloodstream. So cortisol is your stress hormone. So when you have the fight or flight, cortisol gets released into your bloodstream. And by the way, it also blocks access to your higher order thinking. And that's a biological thing, right? So when, you know, when, if everyone else is running, you know, you don't stop and think about whether it's wise to run, you run. So you don't, it blocks access basically to your higher order thinking, and you're more likely to rely on gut.
It's so interesting. Just as an aside, my one son suffers from anxiety, and that's exactly what happens. He shuts down, completely shuts down. And he's having to learn coping skills about how to breathe and recognize that he's shutting down and become a little bit more logical about it. So you actually have to teach your children. And that's why it's actually quite worthwhile understanding these character traits, not even just for your money, but for your children.
Absolutely.
Because
you can develop these things as well. So cognitive behavioral therapy will allow you to develop these skills as well. So I think, I mean, we're in an interesting time. I mean, you know, sort of 30 years ago when I was in school, I mean, you know, we weren't talking about personality traits. And but these days, you know, there are, you know, I think parents obviously being a lot more knowledgeable, but also teachers are learning to identify these things early on, or at least where there's an absence of something to develop the skill. Yeah. So that's basically is the five.
So how do we then translate this into your behavior? So if you are a broad-minded person, or what was it, openness? Just take us through the ocean in terms of your impact on.
Yeah, so you've mentioned a couple already. So if you are quite curious by nature, and if you are open to experiences, you're probably going to value experiences over savings. So you're going to be present orientated. So, you know, if you've got a choice between a trip to, you know, to the Maldives or a trip to, you know, climb Kilimanjaro, you're probably going to prefer that to saving. So you're present orientated. You're about living life in the now. And so that's going to impact your savings behavior as well, or potentially impact your savings behavior. Conscientiousness is the opposite. So people who are conscientious are going to be thinking about retirement a lot more, the future a lot more. So it's going to be easier for them to save. People who are extroverted, for example, the dominant external locus of control kind of people or personality is going to be quite accepting of risk. So they don't see risk the same way. And so very interesting thing about this as well, I mean, I've worked for wealth management firms and Barclays, you know, a long time ago. But when you deal with people who've got a lot of money, the most fascinating thing I found about that was that these people would take an enormous amount of risk in starting these businesses. But when they invest their money, they are extremely risk averse. So again, it's just that it's the perception. You don't have the perception of risk, and that's the important thing, right? So they didn't because they again felt like they had so much more control over their own domain. They didn't see as much risk as maybe other people did. So you know, it's always going to be that that sort of trait as well. Extroversion people are gained, or extroverted people are more likely to accept risk, or they'll be
risk tolerant.
Agreeableness, those are people who generally like doing what other people do. So you would find as well that there might be a trait, you know, so people who are agreeable by nature like being in a herd. So they don't like standing on their own. So if they see that their friends and family are doing things, they are more likely to follow suit. And then finally, the neuroticism one rather is the obvious one, right? That's the anxiety kind of trait where you would be more likely to be loss averse, you know, and you wouldn't be able to stomach these market ups and downs.
So if I had to kind of, a person who's with openness will find it hard to save when there are opportunities, not so much consumption driven maybe, but more experience driven. So they would be really, they would find that they'd have to work quite hard at making sure that they bring in some element of the consciousness, the conscientiousness, should I say. And I'm going to go, because then of course you've got your extrovert. Your extrovert maybe just needs to be reminded about some of the risks that they are facing, and they're not taking on too much risk. But
overconfidence, right? That's
and over, that's where overconfidence comes. But what should the consciousness, that, you know, the person who's conscientious, what should they watch out for? Because that seems to be, you will predict, you'll be good with the future, you'll manage your money well. But what's the downside to that?
Yeah, so I think the likelihood there is that you might be too future orientated. So, you know, you lose out on, you know, I mean, I think these days as well, people are more worried. We've kind of moved into, I think, what people are calling the empathy economy as well, right? So we're forgetting about this thing of a 5-day work week, you know, so forget about this industrial revolution nonsense of a 5-day work week. And because we need, you know, time poverty is, we care about that, right? We don't just want to be the CEO of a company if it means we never get to actually enjoy the money or spend time with our family and friends. So if you think about a lifestyle dividend, for example, that's a thing now. You know, people are like, before I take a job, I want to know what you expect of me. And, you know, am I going to be working evenings and weekends? And then also you have this kind of almost like a memory bank dividend as well. So, you know, if you think about it, I mean, if you accumulate memories or experiences when you're younger, you've got more time in the memory bank, you know, to over the life to live or consume them, right? So if you're going to save everything and then, you know, not experience anything, you know, when you retire, who knows if you'll have your health when you retire as well. So there has to be a balance. Mm. That's the important thing. It can't all just be about sort of saving. And there was a very good example in The Psychology of Money, which I think, by the way, is one of probably the best book I've ever read.
Everyone, if you haven't read it, Morgan Housel, without a doubt, one of the best books I've ever read.
You know, I think the most fascinating thing
I did actually read that right to the end.
Yes, just in one sitting.
In one sitting.
Yeah. But I mean, if you think about sort of, you know, you can read it if you're 18, you can read it if you're a CEO, you can read it if you're a petrol attendant. It will make perfect sense to you. And I think it's one of the few books where that is the case. But he talks about this petrol attendant who managed to save himself into the top, I think, 8% of America's wealthiest people on a petrol attendant salary. And basically, he saved every single cent. You know, he never spent anything. So again, if you're going to die, and I think Leo, I think he left most of his money at the end of the day to charity and hospitals and stuff. I mean, you could ask a question, well, was that worth it? Was that safety that gave you worth not experiencing life? So I think, you know, a lot of attention and focus is always on saving, you know, don't live life in the now, but I think it's balance and that's the important thing.
And the neurotic person, they're going to be sitting in cash. They're going to be, they're not going to be taking the risks they need what's going to happen to them?
Yeah, so good distinction there between, you know, people who are risk averse and who are loss averse. Mm. So, you know, people who are risk averse don't take risk at all. People who are loss averse might take risk, but they sort of, you know, when markets wobble a bit, they sort of de-risk immediately the portfolios. But in both cases, the problem, obviously, if we talked about behavior tax in the last podcast, but here it's inflation is your biggest threat to a behavior tax here, because what happens is if you're sitting in cash over a long period of time, you know, your risk is not just in switching money around, your risk is that inflation is going to outstrip your, you know, the growth of your capital. So the problem again with that kind of nervous, anxious behavior is that you might end up sitting in safe assets and, you know, we need to invest in risky assets. Mm. We need to take risk as well. You know, we can't just avoid that.
No, absolutely. And I think in one of the future podcasts, we are going to be talking about what is risk, because you think sitting in cash is not risky, but over the long term, it's one of the riskiest things you can sit in because of inflation. So really important. And do you think that you can find a balance? I mean, maybe this comes to the nature and nurture story, but do you think you can be, and I'm listening to this, you know, I'm processing myself. I'm definitely open-minded. I'm a little bit that person who wants to always learn about new things, but I definitely have a strong conscientiousness because I do balance. I am going to India in April, but I'm also putting money away for my retirement. So is there a way, and how does nature and nurture come into it? You may be born a certain way, but how can you adapt your behavior?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's where this gets very interesting because, you know, if you've got factory settings, that's one thing. That's part of your genetic code that you get. So you're going to be predisposed to certain things, but your experiences and your friends rather and family and the people around you, social media, for example, is going to impact on how you form your attitudes, beliefs, and values. Mm-hmm. So if you think about someone who's broad-minded, for example, if someone's very, very curious, but if they have a very negative money experience, for example, in childhood, and that's where, you know, that sort of extends to the attitude formation, that can actually change the way that, you know, the kind of traditional cookie cutter kind of personality trait, if we say that, might tweak it in one direction or another. So if you look at your experiences with money early on in childhood, you could develop heightened anxiety around money. You could believe or formulate this very, you know, this faulty belief system that net worth equals self-worth, you know, so you use money to rather prop up your self-worth. And of course you could be, you know, money could be an important source of status for you as well. You know, so that's how the environment really sort of tends to tweak the personality settings that we have. Mm. So we can get into that a bit later.
Well, I want to talk to you about this because you and I were having a cup of coffee earlier and you were telling me about what a car means to you. And I said, please relate this story to our listeners, because I think this is important, because I always, whenever I look at people's finances and they come to me, you know, they write to me and they send me their spreadsheets, cars are a big problem. Car debt is a seriously big problem in South Africa, and trying to understand what's driving that And so I think your story is relevant. Mm. Share it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's one of the weird connections that I made actually later on in life, which was simply that, you know, when my parents used to drop, so again, childhood memories, right? So psychology, there's this thing called imago therapy, which is basically the idea that everything, you know, later on in life is kind of replayed out your childhood experiences and how important your childhood is. But I mean, something as simple as, you know, my parents used to drop me off at school, and it was the same thing you see in the movies, right? So the car was like terrible. It was an old car. The door was like rusted. It was falling off. And I still remember, very funny as well, how sort of impactful emotion is. So I remember the exact color and size of the screwdriver we had to keep in the cubbyhole, because sometimes the car would stall, and then I would have to be the one that used to sort of, you know, get the hood open, take the screwdriver out, and kind of stick it in like a place, you know, and then the car would start again. And of course, what's happening during the wild is there's a crowd of people, sort of people laughing at you, you know, sort of, it doesn't make you feel very good, right? So, I mean, I always used to actually get my parents to drop me off sort of a mile away from school and rather walk. And sort of later on in life, you know, I would, when I looked at my sort of income statement and balance sheet, and I was like, geez, I'm actually spending more money on my car than I am on rent, you know, kind of thing, which doesn't seem odd, right? So, and the interesting thing is, an advisor could tell me a million times that, Paul, you're doing the wrong thing, but I'm not going to change my behavior because of the experience that I've had in my childhood. So you can attack that problem. When I say attack, I mean in terms of advice.
Logically, you say, logically. Well, here, look at the number, which is what I do. I say to people, but how can you be spending 15,000 rand a month on a car repayment when you're spending 8,000 rand a month on your, yeah, on a house or whatever it is? That the mismatch is huge.
But if you don't understand the underlying connection and the underlying sort of belief system that person has, you're not going to change the behavior. So you know, a financial advisor has the ability to impact on a balance sheet, but they also have the ability to impact on well-being. And that's the important thing. So if you're just focusing on the income statements and balance sheet, you're leaving the well-being on the table, right? So you're not breaking that belief system that net worth equals self-worth. You know, you don't have to, and it sounds very logical, right? When I say it, in actual fact, it sounds kind of silly, but it's very important. It's very powerful, right? And again, it's the emotional part of it.
How have you dealt with it in yourself?
Well, I mean, you know, you've got to change the behavior. The only way to do it is work, right? So you have to sit, and you have to understand first. And they say people who study psychology want to understand themselves. And I guess it's exactly the same, right? You first seek to understand, or if you study psychology, you can seek to help other people understand yourself. And
I think understanding yourself first really helps.
Absolutely. And then eventually you can, you know, start addressing these things with spending less, but you have a positive intent behind it because now you understand the root of the behavior. So you need to then, you know, sort of look at things like a 50-30-20 rule, for example, in budgeting, you know, so where you can very clearly say, look, no more than 50% of my income should be spent on house, car, etc. No less than 20% savings, and then no more than 30% for your discretion, you know, your sort of contract spend like cell phones and whatnot. So you can use those systems, make a lot more sense if you can then say, look, this is why it's happened. It's not logical. It's not sort of, I'm not getting actually the benefit I should be. So let's readjust the financial plan, and you're a bit more willing to do it. Let's put it that way.
Just it is. And I think age helps you with that. As you get a bit older, you start to reflect a little bit more and you understand yourself more. So it is difficult when you're in your early 20s to kind of work through all of this stuff. But obviously incredibly important. And you know, you spoke about the role of the advisor in, and a good advisor, because I mean, you know, just selling somebody a product is not advice. It is about, you know, and helping people through it. And I want to unpack that a little bit later in some of our future podcasts as to how advisors can do that. But my question is, are advisors not to some degree influenced by their own personalities or their own experiences? I mean, you spoke about your car experience, but just even in real time right now, I saw a survey that was done of financial planners in South Africa, and they were all asked to answer questions about the future of the country, what they saw, investments, you know, the climate that we're in at the moment. And the KZN advisors were complete and utter outliers. They were so much more negative than all the other provinces. Mm. And if you think about it, it makes sense. They dealt with the riots, those riots 2 years ago. They dealt with floods. They're now dealing with closed beaches. There's been a lot of negativity. They've had to deal with even more negativity than most of the other regions in the country. So now, you know, if you start thinking about that, even on a national level, then on a micro level, that advisor's own experiences within their own lives, how does an advisor, A, prevent themselves from perhaps making decisions based on their experiences? And how as a client, do you filter that as well?
Yes, I mean, exactly. So if you think about it, I mean, if you're a client or an investor, for example, I mean, your advisor is part of the circle around you that's going to inform or help you inform your attitudes. You know, so if you're a negative as an advisor, or you have a particular attitude towards because of your experiences, you know, that will definitely bleed onto the clients. And we've seen that in studies that we've done as well. So we can see that in some cases, advisors tend to, we've done this via a case study survey that we did a couple of years ago with CFP professionals. We could see a very clear group of advisors that would kind of do the same thing, irrespective of whether the client circumstance was changing. So it almost seemed like their inherent attitudes were kind of bleeding more onto the client. You know, in other words, they were their own sort of circumstances were impacting a kind of advice cookie cutter kind of, as opposed to really looking at changing client circumstances. So I think it's a very important question. It's always going to be relevant in any sort of in any industry where judgment sits at the corner, or rather at the center of the proposition. So it's always going to be an issue. But absolutely, yes, the advisor's personality and their own attitudes can absolutely feed out or bleed out rather onto the client and the investment recommendation for sure.
Well, Paul, once again, the most fascinating conversation. We could go on and on, and we can go on and on because we've got more podcasts coming up. But I really want to encourage our listeners to listen out for our next podcast, where we're going to be finding out about the key behaviors that make a successful investor. So, Paul, thank you once again, and looking forward to chatting to you again.
Thanks, Mai.